This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After serving 14 years as the national president of Planned Parenthood, Faye Waddleton has written an autobiography. In 1978, she became Planned Parenthood's youngest president ever, its first African-American president, and the first woman to head the organization since its founder, Margaret Sanger. Under Waddleton's leadership, Planned Parenthood became an activist group, constantly in the forefront of the debate over sex education, birth control, and abortion. The transformation in the agency's image made Waddleton a controversial figure inside as well as outside Planned Parenthood. Outside, many of her most forceful adversaries were fundamentalist Christians who opposed abortion. You may be surprised to learn that Waddleton is from a fundamentalist background. When Faye Waddleton was growing up, her mother was an itinerant preacher in the Church of God. She's now a minister in Atlanta. I asked Faye Waddleton to share some childhood memories of her mother's preaching.
It was very forceful. My mother had her first calling to the ministry at the age of 17, and she was the eldest daughter of a minister, so that she had also learned the art of ministry from her father. I am told that even at a young age, she was very compelling in her message, very dedicated to her work. And that was really what characterized most of her life and her ministry. I mean, it was very powerful. She would stand in one position at the pulpit. She did not jump around. She did not emote a great deal. She read various passages from the Bible to underscore the point that she tried to make. And within minutes after she took the rostrum, people were transfixed in silent attention. And I, as a child, of course, watched that night after night, in week after week, month after month, as we traveled around the country where my mother was a speaker for revival meetings.
You say that she often focused on the sins of the flesh, fornication and adultery. What would she say?
Well, she would speak of them just in those terms. It was not more explicit, but she spoke of adultery. She spoke of against, as she referred to it as the, again, in the Ten Commandments, against adultery. She spoke against fornication, that is, sexual relationships outside marriage. She spoke against homosexuality. Her views were that God loved the person but did not love the behavior. And of course, her mission was to call people from sin and into a life that was in strict reliance to and accommodation to the teachings of the Bible as she interpreted them.
Did you ever break away from your mother's religion? And if so, did you find a new way of expressing faith?
Well, what I try to say in the book is that my life has really been an evolution. And I think from the time that I can remember, I wanted to be a missionary nurse. Now, I'm sure that this was at the suggestion of my mother, although I don't quite remember the moment in which it was offered as my future. But I always wanted to be a nurse, and that was my dream. That was my ambition. My mother also wanted me to have a college education, and so that sort of set me on a path of looking at nursing programs that were in college or university settings. I ended up at Ohio State, and by that time, I wasn't so interested in mission work, that is, going abroad to serve in mission hospitals, but rather in the consumption of my preparation for nursing. And it was really during those years that I began to evolve away from the strict teachings of my parents. I did try to go to church at the beginning of my college years, but then it became too difficult and the workload became so demanding. I worked my way through college. But it was during those years that I saw people who suffered. I did not see people who were evil because they did not belong to the same church that I had been reared in. I did not find myself caught up in all of the dangers of sin that I had been warned against. But more importantly, the nursing profession really more than anything shaped my values about the importance of not judging my patients, as a condition for caring for them. And this was a very important departure because, you see, I had been raised in a very judgmental environment, a very strict environment, one in which adherence to the standards was absolute and a divergence was not tolerated. So that within a nursing preparation context, I really began to evolve into a wider consideration of other possibilities.
Faye Waddleton is my guest. She was the head of National Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Now she has a memoir called Life on the Line. You often debated Randall Terry and other fundamentalist anti-abortion activists. Were there arguments that these activists would make that you already knew inside out because of your upbringing?
Well, I certainly knew the strength of the conviction that those who opposed my work held. And I knew that it was governed by a religious belief that was not transient, that it was something that really was an obligation for the followers to pursue. If one is to be worthy of the life of paradise hereafter, then the teachings require that we adhere to those standards on earth. And so it was really more of the perspective with which they brought to the table that I understood, and really the mandate, if I guess would be the best way to describe it, under which they worked. And while I did not share that view, and I can't say that there were any explicit arguments, because in my household we did not talk about sexual subjects. Certainly the question of birth control and abortion never came up. It did not come up in my mother's sermons either. But I understood the perspective of their fervency. And I also knew that if that fervency were channeled into a political mandate, it could be very dangerous, because there is no one to temper it. Because, you see, the message is that God requires this. And what we were seeing in the late 70s and early 80s were the ministers of fundamentalist denominations compelling their followers to be more political and positioning their religious views as important political mandates. For which God was requiring their followers to adhere and to promote, and in fact to try to get laws to impose.
How would you describe the approach you developed to debating your fundamentalist opponents?
Well, I think it comes from my roots in that I understood the mandate, or their belief in the mandate that they had to carry out. I also had watched my mother many, many years advancing her point of view and never emoting. I mean, she's a very straightforward communicator. While she did not have to debate the point of view, she certainly was able to express herself and never lost focus on what she wanted to say. I think that the reason I was able to debate the opponents to reproductive rights over the years that I served as the president of Planned Parenthood so calmly and so strongly without compromise really emanates more from the experiences that I had before I came to the position than any particular debate technique. As a nurse and trained as a nurse midwife, I saw the circumstances that women found themselves in when they were pregnant and did not want to. I trained in the years when birth control was still illegal in some states, and certainly abortion was illegal throughout the country. I worked my way through college at Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and I saw the experiences or the examples of battered children, of children who had been abused, who had been neglected. So I really came to the debate not from an idea that I had or a conversion that I had, but really from an enormous wealth of experiences. I delivered babies in Harlem Hospital. I cared for women who were injured as a result of illegal and botched abortions. I cared for a young woman who actually died from an abortion. So it was impossible for me to close those situations off in my experience and act as though they did not exist when in the heat of the debate. And it was from those experiences that I always felt the strength to make the point of view and not to get caught up in the emotions of the debate, but to continue to argue the point that these are issues that protect women's lives.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Faye Waddleton. She was the head of National Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Now she's written an autobiography called Life on the Line. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Faye Waddleton, the former national president of Planned Parenthood, now the author of a new autobiography called Life on the Line. Faye Waddleton, you trained as a nurse midwife. Then when you took over National Planned Parenthood in 1978, you led it in a much more activist direction. You led it into the national arena for reproductive rights with an emphasis on abortion rights. Why did you want to see the organization head more in that activist direction?
Well, Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of reproductive health services in the country. I came to the national position after running a local chapter of Planned Parenthood in Dayton, Ohio for 7.5 years. And so I knew the important work that was going on in our clinics and the educational programs in our communities. But I also felt that that gave us a special obligation to speak on behalf of those that I knew did not have the power to speak, the kids that we saw in our clinics, the poor women, the sick women, the well-off women who felt that they could not go elsewhere but had to come to Planned Parenthood. So who was going to speak for them if those of us who were serving them every day did not speak up on their behalf? And so it was really, it seemed to me to be the natural extension of our service mission to be an advocate for the people whom we served and who were now in danger of losing their rights to those services if we did not defend them.
As Planned Parenthood became more of an activist organization, how did your funding picture change? Where did you lose funding? Where did you gain funding?
Well, our funding was under threat from the very early years of my time at Planned Parenthood, because after the Reagan election, the opposition to Planned Parenthood became more focused. So our funding was an immediate focus of attack. Now, this was not just about abortion funding. We were talking about family planning programs were under attack, those programs that were designed to prevent the need for abortion. And we fought opposition to rules that would have required us to report to parents when their teenage daughters came to our clinics. We fought rules that would have required us to withhold information from women about abortion. Domestically, we were able to hold the line on those rules, even though they were passed and they attempted to impose them for a variety of reasons, they were not implemented. Internationally, we were not able to hold the line. We did lose our funding for our international programs because we would not agree to withhold information from women in the developing world where deaths occur at the rate of about 200,000 a year as a result of illegal abortion. And as a result of that, the Bush and the Reagan administrations sought and eventually cut off the right to cut off our funding for international programs.
When the radical fringe of the anti-abortion movement turned violent, many Planned Parenthoods turned into fortresses for the protection of the patients and the people who worked there. I'm wondering what effect that had on your morale and on the morale of other people who worked at Planned Parenthoods around the country.
I think it was very difficult, and it is difficult. The harassment continues. It has persisted for many years. I think it is regrettable that it was not until someone was killed and until the destruction of clinics just became so impossible to ignore that there seemed to be an appreciation for how dangerous the opposition to reproductive rights had become. I mentioned that the first clinic bombing of a Planned Parenthood affiliate occurred in 1977, only 4 years after Roe v. Wade, which was a Supreme Court decision that recognized a legal right to abortion. So this violence has had a very long and difficult history, and the affiliates were often under siege. As you described, they had to install very sophisticated security systems to prevent the destruction of their clinics and also the harm to their patients and to themselves.
What
it was very difficult.
What were the debates inside Planned Parenthood like about what kind of security you should have, whether there should be armed guards there?
There were no debates about that. In fact, we had to accept the reality. And here, Planned Parenthood stood without equivocation that we were not going to close down our clinics, that we would not give in to the violent ways of our opposition, because it would only empower them to go on and to seek more and more dangerous methods of intimidation. So there were no arguments over the need to secure our clinics, and the national organization tried to help the affiliates by instructing them on the very best way to do this. We had very close working relationships with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Unfortunately, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was not as aggressively involved in identifying the more violent elements of the anti-abortion movement, but we did the best that we could to secure the affiliate clinics as well as their patients.
Did you ever wear a bulletproof shield?
I did not wear a bulletproof shield, but I did, from time to time, have to submit to the protection of guards. When death threats came over the switchboard and they were believed to be serious enough, at least for a while, to increase the security around my public appearances, though I did not like the invasion of my privacy and to have someone present with me at all times, I realized the necessity of it. But I also believed that I was not going to let the prospect of violence or harm stop my work, and that I just couldn't worry about it. If someone really wanted to harm me, I was resigned to the fact that they would do so. But that as long as I was silent against these violent forces, they would have their will and their way. And that a very important part of my work was to say that we cannot tolerate this violence. We must, speak and work aggressively against the harassment, because it does promote a violent atmosphere that will allow or, in fact, encourage someone more perhaps unstable to take more aggressive means to impose their point of view.
Do you know if anyone actually tried to hurt you?
There were a couple of experiences that I described that were pretty frightening to me. One that took place after the end of a speech when a father stood up and condemned me very vigorously, verbally, for encouraging his child to violate her parents' and her family's teachings. And he threw an object at me that hit me and struck me in the chest, and for a moment, I thought that he had a gun, and it was a very frightening moment. I was at the podium, unprotected, and as they say, your life sort of begins to trail in front of you, but it only turned out to be a package of unused birth control pills or partially used birth control pills, but it was really a very frightening moment when I realized how vulnerable I was. But also an empowering moment, because I realized that there was really nothing that I could do, and that at least for as long as I was allowed to, I was going to continue the work, and I just simply couldn't think about it. I took reasonable precautions, and when it was advisable to accept more serious protection, I did so, but I never did so for very long periods of time. When I did make public speeches, there were in the latter years always there was security, but that was really about the extent of it in terms of a consistent level of security.
The so-called abortion pill RU486 was conditionally approved by the FDA, so it looks like women will have the option of using that sometime soon in the United States. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this pill.
Well, this is a pill that was developed in France and has been used in Europe for almost a decade now. We have attempted to get this pill approved for use by women in this country as an alternative to surgical abortion for many years, and it's unfortunate that it has taken so long, but I'm glad that it's finally happened. It is not something that will be an easy solution for an unintended pregnancy, because it does require several office visits and the physician's care, but it does allow for a woman who may not want to submit to a surgical abortion when she desires to end an unintended pregnancy, an alternative. There's also methotrexate, which is an anti-cancer drug that is also now being considered as another medical method of terminating a pregnancy. Some would say that this will end the abortion debate. I don't agree. This has not been an issue about a surgical technique. It has been an issue of whether women will have the right to have full control over their reproduction. And RU486 gives another tool for women to control their reproduction. And I am certain that those people who are opposed to that fundamental power and freedom will continue to fight the battles.
Faye Waddleton, I have one last question for you. When you were the head of Planned Parenthood, you fought very hard for the right of women to choose to have an abortion. You were brought up in a very strict Christian fundamentalist family that didn't believe in contraception, let alone abortion. Do you think that you could have had an abortion yourself? Would your own faith allow you to have one if you wanted to?
I don't know what would have happened if I had been faced with that circumstance, but if the conditions were such that it was in my best interest, either for my health or my welfare, I would, and I believe that I could have faced that situation. Would I have preferred to not face it? Absolutely, and I'm glad that I did not have to. But I do not believe that I would have, under no condition, said that this is not something that I would have done.
Faye Waddleton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Faye Waddleton was the national president of Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Her new autobiography is called Life on the Line. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.